Ladies and gentlemen of the House and the Senate, our governor, Mitch Daniels.
Governor Mitch Daniels delivered his 8th and final State of the State address on Tuesday to cheers from fellow Republicans, jeers from union protesters, and a number of empty desks on the Democratic side of the Indiana House chamber. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, the governor won't encounter any of those things, just lots of questions about his speech, his hopes for the 2012 legislative session, and his political legacy. All that and more on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park. 4 locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park. The idea economy is here.
Toward the end of his State of the State address, Mitch Daniels pulled out a gift he'd received from a former governor in another state, an atomic clock that constantly reminds him of his time left in office. As of Tuesday night, it stood at 369 days. Now, I don't have an atomic clock, so I grabbed my son's soccer referee watch to remind me that we have less than 30 minutes to cover a whole lot of topics. So let's get right to it with Governor Mitch Daniels. I have my watch here, so
I'm on the clock?
We're on the clock.
Okay.
This is the 8th time you've given the State of the State address and the 8th time you've come here in the days afterward to talk about it. I appreciate your maintaining that tradition throughout your tenure in the governor's office. Let's start with something really, really important, and that is the fact you just became a grandfather for the first time back on January 2nd, Audrey Lynn, right?
Audrey Lynn is correct.
So two questions come to mind. One, you're a dedicated motorcycle rider. Are you going to let her ride a motorcycle?
Oh, probably not. Let's just say not for a good long while.
Okay.
But so it won't be my call. You know,
I
know this is a different role than I do. At least I can be of some use. I told the father if it's a boy, I'm probably not much use to you. I have no more experience than you do. If it's a girl,
if it's a girl,
I've seen it all with 4 of them. So maybe here and there, I'll be good for a little advice.
Well, and then so we've got the motorcycle taken care of. Now, some people would say the only thing more dangerous maybe than riding a motorcycle with or without a helmet might be entering politics. So tell me, and this is only a somewhat tongue-in-cheek question, with the climate we see in the State House and in politics across the country, could you in good conscience tell Audrey Lynn, yeah, elective office is something that would be wise to seek?
Sure. I mean, good people better not be deterred, and I trust that she'll grow up to be a good person. But, it'll be a very different environment, whatever it is, when she and what I hope becomes a parade of sisters and brothers and cousins come along.
But it is very contentious right now. Again, all you have to do is look at the campaign trail. All you have to do is walk a few blocks down and look at what we see under the rotunda dome at the State House. Is it as contentious, as polarized as what you've seen at any time during your tenure as governor?
Oh, it depends. I wouldn't read too much into the stuff at the State House. You know, it is not.
That's where the action is right now.
Well, I know, and all's fair. But you know, when you're paying people to show up, when you're paying for the signs, you're paying for the buses, you're paying for the shirts, it's not too hard to get a few hundred people together. It's perfectly within folks' rights to do that, and every special interest tries to magnify its voice, shout a little louder. But you know, John, I just wouldn't read too much into it. There's the folks paying for those rallies represent fewer than 9% of Indiana workers, and a lot of their workers don't agree with their position. So they have every right to be there, and their rights must be respected. But you know, let's don't overread what it means.
Are you suggesting, though, that the people who have shown up and were there the very first day that the Senate was gaveled into session and the House, there was an attempt to gavel it into session, that those people were showing up solely because they were paid and bus trip out of it?
No. If you're a part of one of those organizations, and particularly if you're a full-time part of it, this is bread and butter to you. No, I'm sure they believe sincerely what they're doing. I'm just saying you're asking about the overall climate, and you know, you're dealing here with a tiny fraction, really, of 1% of Hoosiers who have been any part of that. When you ask about the broader climate in our politics and our campaigns, yeah, that's troublesome. Of course it is. We've tried to avoid it here in Indiana. I'm able to leave public life in a year knowing that we never made a negative commercial, never attacked anybody's character, motives. background. There's way too much of that going on. And I keep trying to persuade people. I even wrote a chapter about it in this book I wrote, that you can do better, you can get better results if you don't get dragged into that than if you do.
Well, good point. And since this is Indiana Lawmakers, though, I will focus back on Indiana politics and the legislature for a moment. And again, this notion of political division right now. The reason we're seeing that debate and that polarization right now is, by all accounts, the right to work legislation that you are advocating, that both caucuses, Republican caucuses in the House and Senate, are advocating. And for those who have been asleep over the past few weeks and haven't seen the commercials and so forth, basically this would bar any, the legislation would bar any private company from entering into an agreement or a contract that would force a workforce to pay for union representation. That's your priority. Why? You had to know going in that this was going to be a very much a hot button lightning rod issue.
Yeah,
why pick this one as your swan song, the top of your last agenda?
Well, it didn't come to that quickly, obviously. We were 7 years. We learned a lot in 7 years. We learned we lose a lot of jobs in Indiana. I've talked to companies from elsewhere who won't look at us and told them about all our other advantages. It's pretty clear what the one thing is. All the site selectors tell you this. So it's just been a learning experience. On top of all that, if the national economy were still strong, there'd be enough shots for us to continue on with this handicap. But those two conditions are the reasons that I eventually came to agree with those who think we should do this. It's all about jobs for those who don't have them, and we need every advantage we can get.
Now, you mentioned it today, that there are a number of companies that simply will, as it's looking around for a possible site, crosses Indiana off the list. And you mentioned that in the television spots that I alluded to a moment ago that are showing around the state, where you refer to maybe as many as one-third of all prospects turn their back on Indiana for that reason. I know everybody has been clamoring. Just name one company. I asked, when I had legislative caucus leaders here on the show last week at the roundtable, I asked, can anybody name one company that was interested in Indiana and turned away because of this? Can you name one company?
Yeah, I think, Volkswagen, Hyundai, they wouldn't even return our calls. Now, listen. Well, listen, when you see the intimidation tactics that we're seeing right now, you know, you can understand why would any company want to buy into that? Plus, under federal law, if you make a peep that someone can construe as anti-union, you're subject to being sued or have an unfair labor practice complaint. And now you're into legal expense, right? You probably win, but it's the harassment. Why would they want that issue? But there isn't any question about this, John. And again, the people who advise these companies not only tell us, they've said very openly in testimony here, it is very widespread. I would have remained in the position that let's just keep soldiering on with the laws we have.
Of course, for every representative of every state, we'll take Oklahoma, for instance, that was the last state to embrace right-to-work legislation 10 or so years ago. You had people come in from the chamber saying this was the greatest thing, and then, of course, this past week we had labor representatives come in and say, not so fast, it wasn't so great. So,
well, maybe not for their special interest, but it was very good for Oklahoma. And the facts, you know, are what they are. They've grown jobs, they've grown income, as right-to-work states have in general, much faster than those without. So, you know, this is not some radical notion. Almost half of America has it. And, it's an interesting thing. The entire rest of our agenda, I think I named 18 items in the speech the other night. The other 17, by any fair definition, are bipartisan or nonpartisan, just good government things. And I appreciate, as I've said over and over, the passion of people whose organizational bread and butter comes from compulsory dues. And frankly, their political clout, which they keep bringing up, is not. It really doesn't matter to me. You know, I've run in my last election. We did just fine despite all the union money spent against us. It's not a factor at all with me. It's just about jobs. But the
do you think it's a factor with anybody else?
They say
the
so.
Republican?
On our side, I don't think so. I mean, you know, that it's just a fact of life that we will have a better opportunity going forward if if we don't, if we join the list of states that provides this protection.
I'm just curious, and I will talk about some other things. You mentioned 18 things, we'll get to them. But do you see why, aside from the meat and potatoes, dollars and cents issues, you could argue, and many have, that if unions are weakened, of course, it affects Democratic candidates moving forward, because it's no secret if you look at campaign finance reports, unions tend to support financially through their PACs and their giving. So here, you're a student of politics. I mean, you were the political director for Ronald Reagan in the White House. That makes you the top political mind, I guess, at some point.
No, he was.
He was. All right. Yeah. You're the second one then. So given that, just in a sure, we'll take the dollars and cents out of it. Does this bode ill for Democrats if this is enacted because of the financial reasons, because of the clout or perceived lessening of clout
of
unions?
Well, they say so, so I take them at their word. But, you know, taking money involuntarily from people and recycling it into politics, not exactly, and therefore creating more political clout than your numbers in a democratic system justified, not exactly an admirable thing. That's called, you know, special interest with a very special feature, namely you get the money whether the donor wants you to have it or not. So it's no part of my agenda. As I said, I've run in my last election. We did okay despite all that money spent against us. I have no reason to have come to the position that I'm in except for the one I keep giving, which is we've got to think about the 91% plus in this state who aren't part of these organizations, and many of whom are out of work or will be if we don't do better.
Who's winning the PR battle at this point? Clearly, we've seen television and radio spots from both sides of this issue. There was a $600,000 buy that featured someone very familiar to you. I guess it was you, in fact, featured in those spots. Do you sense that that's moving the numbers? You've said early on, or I think you say in the spot, in fact, that there's a ratio of people who support this among Hoosiers is what you say 2-1. Although we see numbers from Ball State that suggest that it's much more even than that.
I don't know where Ball State got that. I've seen three national surveys by nationally famous pollsters. You know,
I think this was a survey done by the Bowen Institute.
Yeah,
named after one of your predecessors, James Bowen.
All I can say is it's a total outlier, and I haven't seen anything in the last week. I don't know if there's been some movement one way or another, but there's incredible consistency to the three or maybe it's four that I've seen. And, you know, Hoosiers just think it's fair, or I should say it the other way. They don't think it's fair to coercively take money from somebody who doesn't want to pay the dues, and they do believe that we'd be better off economically if we join the 22 states that have this law.
One more question about the television commercial, funded, of course, by the Indiana Opportunity Fund, newly created organization to advance the cause of right to work. You're the star of that spot. There's been a call for people on the part of critics of this legislation to say, hey, who's funding this? Who are the donors? And there's been a reluctance to say. Now, I know in the newspaper business, if a reporter is going to go do a freelance story where he or she is paid by somebody else, the editor knows, and oftentimes it's disclosed. So you work for the citizens of the state of Indiana. You're kind of doing a freelance gig here, if you will, for another organization. Do they, as your boss, have a right to know who funded that in detail? And if so, are you willing to say who the big donors are?
I'm doing the job I was hired to do. I'm trying to get more jobs into this state. I'm trying to build a better climate of opportunity in Indiana, and I am simply explaining the reasons for the position that I've come to any way that I can.
So in terms of disclosure, you don't think it's important necessarily that those names of those donors be disclosed at this point?
Be fine with me, but it's up to them whether, and again, this is a little bit unusual. Just look at the intimidation and bullying tactics that are tried. You know, we had people show up outside confront the wives and children of some of the legislators who had the effrontery to say they were for this bill. And so you can understand why people would be a little reluctant to expose themselves to that.
In this past week, we saw perhaps some thawing in this. Maybe that's an overstatement, but at least Brian Bosma and Pat Bauer have agreed that there will be a full hearing of Democratic amendments on the floor on Tuesday in the House, perhaps with a vote later in the week, which backs up the timetable by about a week.
Yeah.
Do you read that as a sign for optimism or just another
temporary
bump in what promises to be a continuing bumpy road?
Well, we'll see. You know, if Leader Bauer and his people keep their word, it's a very positive thing. They said they wanted more time. Probably goes back to your previous question. Maybe they could effect a big change, a big reversal in public outlook and change a lot of people's minds. I don't see that happening, but, you know, possibility.
And so they change your mind at this point?
I've just looked at the facts, and they tell me, they point all in one direction to me. But, you know, others might come to a different conclusion. And so I don't see anything wrong with this process having been extended as it has. And so, yeah, I think it's a good compromise if both sides honor it. And, you know, this thing did not suffer, really, from haste. You might remember, John, when I think I was here last year, we were discussing why I didn't think it should be moved last year. It's a big subject. There was a lot to learn. A lot of people needed to be heard. We had a year of it.
And in fact, if memory serves, last year you advised your fellow Republicans not to take it up last year.
That's exactly right. In that respect, you could say I agree with the Democrats here that this is a big subject that deserves a fair and open hearing. Airing, but it got a year of it. Hearings all over the state, summer study committee, not to mention the things that have taken place as the session got closer. So I think now it is time that it's ripe, let's say, for vote.
So now, even if this is pushed back a week and that timetable is adhered to, this would, by my calculation, still get done before the Super Bowl, before February 5th. And there's no secret that Republican lawmakers, and I presume maybe your administration, would like to see it done before the Super Bowl. Is that true? And if so, why is it important to get that done?
I think we're talking about something for the long-term future of Indiana. If it takes longer to do it, it does. I personally think there's no reason for delay, you know, past what's been agreed to. Look, 31 of the 45 Super Bowls have taken place in right-to-work states. More than, you know, 7 in 10. And nobody, you know, thought to politicize any one of those, and I just don't think people do that here. I think it would blow up in the face of anybody who did to start messing around, not just with a fun event, try to sour it, but you know, we got 10 or 15,000 Hoosiers who are going to earn money around that event. Anybody who does anything that hurts that event is hurting working people. And so I just don't think anybody would be so reckless or uncaring as to do that.
Well, this week the NFL Players Association, a union, released letters that six NFL players from Indiana, Rex Grossman and others, have written open letters effectively, but ostensibly to members of the General Assembly. Does that tread in the danger zone that you just alluded to, that people
Look, I understand. They're under pressure from other unions to show a little solidarity. Fine. But again, nobody wrote those letters at 31 of the previous 45 Super Bowls. It's pretty obviously just a political stunt, and you know, all's fair, but I wouldn't overread it any more than I overread well-funded rallies of a few hundred people.
So if this particular issue doesn't get done before the Super Bowl, you can live with that. However, there are two other issues that you really want to see done before folks show up in town to celebrate what arguably is the biggest sporting event next to the Indy 500. We don't want the George home and George family to get mad here. It's a big event. You want a statewide smoking ban enacted before folks arrive, and you also want to see new restrictions on human trafficking to combat prostitution issues, which you say follow the Super Bowl apparently wherever it has gone. Why those two issues? Why is it so important to act now to have that legislation in place?
Well, specifically the second one, and I confess this is a subject I didn't know much about till about a year ago. From two or three different directions, activists on behalf of young women came around, began educating me. And one thing I learned is not only the scale, the horrific practices that go on, the penetration of organized crime and all of that, but that events, very specifically the Super Bowl, big, high-dollar sporting events are the worst places, the epicenters of this activity. So that one, absolutely, we need that law in place that really will put up a sign that says you'll be easy to convict in Indiana. All the usual outs won't get you out if we catch you doing this. The smoking ban, yeah, I mean, I think it would be much better. The city of Indianapolis might move on its own in the interim.
Some bars have even taken that step voluntarily, I understand, right, as they prepare to greet Super Bowl fans.
Right. So I haven't personally said that it must be done ahead of time. I think it'd be a very good idea to do it. It's just a good idea to do. Anyway, by the way, John, it's another subject, by way of full disclosure, that in which my views evolved over time. Very like right to work. For a long time, I said I wish people didn't smoke, but I don't think we need a law. But the evidence piled up, both of health risks to workers who don't have the choice necessarily to just go somewhere else, and of public support growing for it. So there's a real parallel between those two issues. And be fair for somebody to say, wait a minute, you didn't call for this 3, 5, 6 years ago. True. But you live and learn, at least if you let the facts, you know, tell you what's right.
And you mentioned Indianapolis might act on its own, which opens the door to a quick, and my atomic watch tells me we're almost out of time, discussion of local government reform. This has been a mantra of yours for a number of years. You've sort of scaled it back to deal with nepotism and conflict of interest and some of those issues this year. Is this the year you will be able to chalk up some successes?
I think so. There are parallel bills in both houses. I visited with the chairman and the leadership. I think we will end the era of conflict of interest and nepotism in Indiana this year. I've got some hopes also, at least on a local option basis, that counties will have the opportunity to go to a single county commissioner, a single executive, not the rather strange three-headed executive that we all have today. So, I'm hopeful, and that'll leave a lot of work for future years, but sometimes you have to progress incrementally.
And as I hear the tick, 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 or see the tick, 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 usually every year you've been here, and at least in the past few, I've started with a question about your presidential aspirations. I'll end with it this time. Uh-huh. As you watch what we've seen in Iowa, as we've seen in New Hampshire, as we look forward to South Carolina, it is, some would say, the proverbial circular firing squad. You, by all accounts, could have gotten that nomination or would be sitting pretty at this point. Any regrets at all?
I regret that we're, as a nation, still not moving on the dangers that face us all. It's so much bigger than anything we've discussed here in Indiana. If we don't begin to act boldly at the national level, we're all going to suffer, regardless of income or geography or race or anything. So that I'm regretful about. But you know, great saying, the cemeteries are full of indispensable men. Never saw myself as indispensable. Hope to be useful in some way, but if I had run, among other things, I'd have been in Iowa the night that Audrey Lynn was born. I think our family made the right decision.
Sounds like the speech of a future vice presidential candidate, maybe.
Oh, John, you're just relentless, you know. I hope that those who read or heard the speech the other night, if nothing else, saw that we are going to use every day. We've got a lot of things we're going to do as an administration, things we hope the legislature will help us do too. And Indiana's a leader now, and it's important, once you are one, to keep leading and keep innovating. That's what we plan to do.
All right. Governor Mitch Daniels,
thanks,
you,
John,
again for being here. Very much appreciate your keeping the 8-year tradition alive of joining us.
Wouldn't have missed it.
Very much appreciate it. Thank you. The right to work issue continues to spark division on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter, Indiana Legislative Insight. No grandkids to report on your front, right?
And not even on the clock, as far as I know.
Father's relief. All right. Anything surprise you about the right to work discussion?
I think that the governor went into a little bit more detail than I might have expected. I thought he'd probably just kind of take a nice, gracious victory lap and say, you know, we fought a good battle, everybody did, and move on from there. I thought he got into a little bit too much of the thicket there and said a little bit too much about the union tactics. And I was also very intrigued to hear the names of two firms that he actually mentioned that didn't come to Indiana or wouldn't talk to Indiana because of right to work.
First time I think we've actually heard some names associated with that. Does that come back to bite him? You mentioned he was in the thick of things a little bit. Is there a downside for him politically?
I don't think so at this point in his term, but the bigger question is, does it poison the water even more for life after right to work this session? And I think that's the big question now.
That is a good question. Is there life after right to work? I mean, what this appears to be now moving toward the conclusion that seemed inevitable because of the numbers in the House and Senate from the outset. What happens next?
Democrats have to decide whether they're going to put bygones behind them now and say, all right, well, we've got some priorities and we can affect some of the other legislation and let's do it and let's move forward. Or they can just say, hey, we're not happy. We're going to slow things down again. We're going to block other pieces of legislation. We're going to make life difficult for you. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Can they afford, given their union support, and we've seen a lot of organized labor saying, you got to be there with us on this, do they run a risk if they move on to other issues?
Well, if right to work is done, it's done. There's nothing more they can do on that.
All right. Very good, Ed. Thanks, as always, for your insight.
For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Lawmakers under News. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Chwanis. We'll see you next week. Take care.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park at Ameriplex Indianapolis. Set on 80 acres near the new International Airport, the Purdue Research Park at Ameriplex Indianapolis. The idea economy is here.